We do have some special guests today, Marjorie and Leonard Chrétien. That's a little difficult name to say, I understand. It's French for Christian. At the age of 26, Leonard and Marjorie were baptized as Jehovah's Witnesses. Since then, their life has gone through a dramatic change. What I'd like to do, Leonard and Marjorie, first of all, welcome. It's good to have you with us. What I'd like to do is go back before you became a Jehovah's Witness. What was your background before you became witnesses?
My mother had a penchant for religion, but not in a deep way. My father is, I guess even to this day, basically an agnostic.
Leonard and I walked into a Kingdom Hall. We had been married about 6 months, and we went into a Kingdom Hall to listen to the public talk. And after the talk was finished, we approached a group of gentlemen at the back of the Kingdom Hall, and we asked, would it be possible to have one of these home Bible studies? You can imagine how pleased they were.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, a home Bible study, book study, was started with us. And
okay, now you mentioned a public meeting. What is that? Is this an open forum where people can come and explore the faith? Is that what it's for?
At the Kingdom Hall on a Sunday afternoon or morning, whatever, they have a two-hour meeting. The first meeting is a public meeting. The public is invited, and usually a discourse is given. The second hour is the Watchtower study, where they study out of their Watchtower magazine. And, of course, the public's invited to that as well. But we happened to go for a specific talk that was advertised on evolution because of Leonard's interest in that.
Oh.
And enjoyed it so much that we thought, well, now we must make these forward moves that we had talked about as an engaged couple. Should we investigate this religion to find out if really, in fact, it was the truth?
What did you find appealing about the Jehovah's Witnesses? What was it that really got you involved to the point where a couple of years later, you're now a full-fledged Jehovah's Witness, you're baptized into the faith. Later, Leonard, you became an elder. What was it that was the appeal? Marjorie?
For me, it was definitely that image of a clean, moral organization. I was a very, I guess, the type of person who really did feel that one should have high morals and should live a clean life, a godly life. And I looking at them, I felt that they represented that. They certainly presented that picture.
Wanted
to be a part of that kind of a religious organization.
Yes, I think that appealed to me, too. The other thing was that this idea of the fact that Armageddon was about to break loose at any time, that the...
Now, this is their teaching.
This is one
of the first things you learn.
Exactly. And, in fact, that's the teaching to this day. As a matter of fact, it's been their teaching for over 100 years of their complete history. That this thing was about to break loose, that unless you came to a knowledge of these things and became part of God's quote-unquote organization, you would not be saved. You would not live through this cataclysmic end of the world. And obviously, if a person desired life, he would investigate it. The other, it's a push-pull situation. You're obviously being pushed towards it by the fear that this is going to happen.
Right.
The pull is that, and the good news is that you would pass through this time of trouble, this battle of Armageddon, end of the world, and you would actually be ushered into the new world of righteousness without ever dying. You would pass right through and never taste death. Now, this has to appeal to certainly a Bible literate like myself. I didn't really have a real good understanding of the kingdom and God's purposes and so forth. And on the surface, it sounds like a real fine thing. And so, with the fact that it appealed to us from the moral standpoint, as far as we knew at that time, as an elder later on, of course, I learned that these people were no different than anybody else. And in many cases, there's some very sad things going on, but. On the surface, and the appearance of it being an organization like that, it had an overall very strong appeal to both of us.
It would appear to me that one of the appeals of the Jehovah's Witnesses is they do have a sense of community. They seem to have an identity, and that people who are lonely, in need of affection, need of intimacy, need of someone nurturing them, that's oftentimes the person that is very open to receiving a Jehovah's Witness.
I think in my experience I could agree with you 100%, John, because in fact, with the door-to-door canvassing, which is essentially it's proselytizing, they will tell you that they're not there to change your religion and so forth, but that's exactly the purpose. You have a dragnet out there and you're bound to find all manner of people, and you do find people that are lonely and have just lost somebody in death, perhaps, individuals themselves that have no Bible background and are open to a message like this. And yes, there is a close, tight community, and that's by design.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when you think about it, you are basically corralled into this organization, and you're taught very quickly, right from the beginning, that unless people are in agreement with you on these matters, unless they accept, as it were, your belief system that you're now embracing, you don't have anything to do with them, because they are worldly. They're going to be a worldly influence. You could have friends that you've had for all of your life, and if they don't agree with the Watchtower tenets, then you better just put them to the side. You better not have anything more to do with them. You have new friends, this new family, this almost hermetically sealed community that you become part of, yes.
Very separatistic.
Very much so.
I think one of the strong attractions, too, is that the Jehovah's Witnesses will point out to you the new proselyte. They will show you all of the, draw your attention to all of the problems in the world, and we're all aware of that. But then they tell you that there's going to be a change, that God has this marvelous plan for the earth in mind, and that you, this little individual, you feel that you are so helpless with all these terrible problems in the world, but they now say you can have a part in bringing about this wonderful new world. You can be important. You can now go out into the world and save people from destruction. And it's for the person who is an idealist, who really has a love of mankind, really wants better things for their fellow man. They
and
say,
wants
wonderful,
to feel worthwhile and important.
Wonderful.
Right.
Wonderful. I can actually have a part in God's work. And it gives a sense of purpose to many people's lives that they can now work in God's field.
Not only were you baptized as Jehovah's Witnesses, but beyond that, Leonard, you became an elder in the church. What does that mean? We know what it means in a Christian church, but in the context of the Jehovah's Witnesses, what does that mean?
I suppose that there are certain similarities in that the elders have the oversight of the congregation. In fact, we are, if you will, the pastors of the congregation. It's a system of, it's a body of elders. There's the presiding overseer and a whole bunch of different offices.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes if there's a congregation that only has a few elders, for example, maybe three or four, they might have to hold one or two of the offices. If there are enough elders, then you have an office per elder. They essentially are the direct link with the Watchtower headquarters. They answer, obviously, to the Watchtower, and to a measure to each other, but they really have the final say in the way a congregation is run. They run it, of course, according to Watchtower rules. They have assistants, which would be, I suppose, similar to a deacon,
mm-hmm.
Ministerial servants, and we would assign them different jobs, taking care of the literature, taking care of this, that, and the other thing, more mundane jobs. But the leadership and the teaching responsibilities were the responsibilities of the elders. I basically had all the various assignments. They used a rotational system where each year you'd rotate into these various assignments. It was an idea to keep the thing sort of balanced, and presumably, I think the principle was good in a way that there wouldn't be the stamp of one man in any one of the positions particularly. However, they've reversed themselves on this recently because of all the problems they've been experiencing since the late 70s, and now there is one permanent presiding overseer. And basically, he will be, if I can use the expression, a Watchtower man. He'll be a man that really toes the line according to Watchtower doctrine. I had, as a matter of fact, I was the presiding overseer of our local congregation the year I resigned as an elder over mm-hmm. some of the issues that we'll be talking about. I had also had the main teaching position of the Watchtower Overseer, which is the main teaching magazine or journal of the Watchtower, and that's the part that Marjorie was talking about earlier. On the Sundays you have the public discourse, and then you have the Watchtower Study, which is the main study journal. It whenever there's changes of doctrine, nuances of change, whatever, all of these things are developed very, very carefully in a question and answer forum with the congregation. I did that for a few years as well.
Leonard, here you are an elder, you are a leader, you are a teacher. Something happened in 1975 that caused you to start to doubt. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. I think what happened there, and it was quite a disappointment and a shock to many people, was that the world didn't end. The Watchtower Bible and Tract Society from the mid-1960s on had predicted the end of the world for 1975. It's sad to say that the average person who would ask a Jehovah's Witness about this today, they would receive a response somewhat like this: we didn't say anything. They said it, then they tried to backpedal out of it in 1976. 75 came, nothing happened.
Now, you obviously believe this because, again, I have read your testimony. You sold a very profitable business as well as your home in order to give yourself to the kingdom in anticipation of 1975.
Yes, we felt that 1975 was it, as many Jehovah's Witnesses did, and we were counseled, in fact, that was a fine thing to do. That was a wise thing to do, to divest yourself of these things and work hard for the incoming kingdom just around the corner.
Did you both agree to do that? Marjorie,
yes.
You were that committed.
Yes.
You know, and as a Jehovah's Witness comes to my door, I see that commitment. And that's why I appreciate so much your love for those people, even though you have left, your love for them, your compassion for them, because they are devout, committed people.
Oh, yes, indeed. That is exactly how Marjorie and I feel about the rank-and-file Jehovah's Witness. The poor dear soul is an individual that has been deluded. He's been deceived by his leadership and believes completely that the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society is God's only true organization on the planet. And he follows emphatically whatever edicts come out of Brooklyn. So no, they are sincere, like you say, and we don't feel animosity towards them. They, of course, cannot have anything to do with us, which is something we'll talk about momentarily, I'm sure.
What did you expect to happen in 1975? You had studied and been told that 1975 was the end of the world, that you were the chosen ones to continue on into the next world. You sold your home, you sold your business, you're waiting for this great future. 1975 comes and goes.
Comes and goes.
How did you feel?
I think flat, a little disappointed, like many did. Marjorie and I, nevertheless, we were Watchtower soldiers. We just thought, well, maybe they're off a little bit on their timing. Maybe it's, you know, another year or two or whatever. We weren't ready to throw in a towel.
You were gracious, in other words.
Yes, well, we felt that obviously it wasn't God's time for it. We were still young enough to go on with our life. We made a decision at that point, meanwhile, to move to the United States because we had no other ties, having sold everything, and we moved down to California.
Now, you were living in Canada.
Yeah, we were living in Toronto
at that time. So now we moved to the United States, moved to California, and really, it's a beautiful place to live. We continued to serve in our local congregation. We were quite happy waiting on Jehovah and His time. Meanwhile, what was really disappointing was that the Watchtower Society itself handled the 1975 date in such a way that they tried to blame it on the followers, that they had come to this expectation on their own.
But where did they come up with it in the first place? It's a very big question to me.
Well,
how did they come up with 1975 in the first place?
Okay, they're very chronology-oriented, extremely so. The whole basis for their belief system is chronology.
Mm-hmm.
And they were teaching in a book called Life Everlasting and Freedom of the Sons of God, this is where they first really strongly developed this, that 6,000 years of mankind's history would end in 1975, and that the end of the world would come so that then the millennial reign would begin, so that you'd have a complete seventh day of 7,000 years. They believe that there was 7,000, each day represents 7,000 years. It's a very complicated exegesis, but I'm giving it to you very simply. And they mentioned in that book that 1975 would see the end of this period of time. Human history would have been 6,000 years long, 6,000 plus 1,000 millennium, 7,000. The millennium had to begin around 1975.
And they would see faithful Jehovah's Witnesses as the rulers during the millennium.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was what was, I think, the thing. Not that I was not what they might call a 75-er. I wasn't stumbled over and all upset because 75 hadn't brought the end of the world. No, it was the way they handled it that bothered me, that they just didn't admit that they had been wrong. We had lived through it. We knew what they had taught. We knew what we had taught people door to door. We knew that we had received that information through their publications, that they had taught it to us, and we had taught it to the public. The fact that they would not be humble enough to just say, hey guys, we were wrong,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to waffle about whose responsibility it was. Well, it started for the first time a thinking process that up till then I had not allowed myself to go through. I must say that a very, very strong thing that really, really got me thinking was the Jonestown massacre in Guyana.
Mm-hmm.
I knew there that 900 and some people obviously believed that their leader, Jim Jones, was a man that they should die for because they had drank poison and allowed their children to die. I reasoned with myself that I had resolved as a Jehovah's Witness to die for this religion that I was in.
I mean, how many Christians would sell their home, sell their business in pursuit of the kingdom of God, even if they knew we're coming tomorrow? I'm amazed at your graciousness as well as your commitment.
Many Jehovah's Witnesses do die for their faith over the blood issue.
Right, transfusion.
Or in the Second World War in the concentration camps of Nazi Germany. In Malawi during the persecution there in the 70s, there was witnesses were murdered. So witnesses are prepared to die for their what they are taught by their leaders. Looking at Jonestown, I had to say, Marjorie, are you willing, you are willing to die for, at the words of these men, you had better be pretty sure that you're following true prophets, because the men in Jonestown and the women in Jonestown died in vain. With that, I, for the first time, when I look back on it, realize that I finally put my faith in God's hands, because I prayed to Jehovah that I believe I was in the truth. But if I was not, he would have to be the only person who could ever show me that it was not the truth. And I realize now I gave it to God. And, of course, we have a very powerful God. He took over, and everything started to happen.
Tell me about that. You started to study. You started to research. You started to check out the teachings of the Watchtower.
Kind of unusual the way it happened too, John, as a matter of fact. It's interesting, as Marjorie relates how her mind is working, so is mine. Mm-hmm. There are many things that I was not necessarily sharing with Marge as an elder. We handled many things in the congregations. There were things that we were not to tell our wives, and we didn't. I was handling many judicial cases, which is a situation where the elders get together and handle matters from immorality to even smoking. We disfellowship people for smoking cigarettes and things like that, which is its own story. But I was seeing things that I wasn't sharing necessarily with her, some of the things that I felt were very inconsistent with a group of people that were supposed to be the nucleus of the new order so close at hand and so on. So I too was wrestling with this whole matter of the way they had handled 75. But when Marjorie gave up that prayer, she didn't realize, and certainly neither did I didn't know that she'd given that prayer, that the answer would come in an elders' meeting not too many months later. We were having one of our, what we called a quarterly elders' meeting. We would get together quarterly and handle things and talk about things sometimes for a whole day with respect to the direction of the congregation and so forth. And we had just arrived, and we were sitting talking for a moment or two before we got the meeting underway. One of the other elders came in, and he had this big brown manila envelope, and he said one of the brothers had brought it to him the night before at the service meeting, and said, we've just got this in the mail. We believe it's from the apostates, so-called apostates, persons who had turned against the Watchtower. This was really getting ahead of steam at the time. And he said, and I commended him for not reading it, because he said he didn't read it, and I commended him for not reading it, because they're discouraged from reading this material, or forbidden, in fact. And I said, you discouraged him? You commended him for that, Jim? He said, oh, yeah. He says, and I said, well, listen, I said, as far as I'm concerned, if we've got the truth, we should be able to blow that thing away. He said, Leonard, I'm not so sure. This is not so easy to blow away. I said, oh, really? I said, let me have that. We've got to get this meeting underway. I'd like to see what it is they're saying, because we're going to be having to handle this, gentlemen, in the next while, because it's getting worse all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I brought this document home with me, and it was 13 pages of questions, many questions that I had myself, and subsequently I found that Marjorie had too. Mm-hmm. I sat down and read the whole works, and when I was finished, I said to my wife, an elder says to his wife, Marjorie, read this. And the questions that were in there were very, very sobering, very sobering. And so that was sort of the start of the real investigation. That was the beginning of it.
Leonard, you're an elder, Jehovah's Witness elder. You are given a package that's said to come from an apostate. Now, I understand typically you shouldn't have even looked at the package and what it contained. The Jehovah's Witnesses are really told not to really pursue anything outside of Watchtower literature, if I understand it right.
Yes, actually, the interesting thing is, John, it's rather dichotomous situation, because where we are forbidden to read, or they are, I say we, they, mm-hmm. they are forbidden actually to read any material that is in opposition to Watchtower theology. Anything that would oppose the Watchtower to any degree is forbidden to read. Now, this lies in the face of a book that they have printed into millions. It was a main study book for many, many years. It was called The Truth That Leads to Eternal Life. And in a particular chapter, they say this. Now, this is directed to the householder that they're endeavoring to proselytize into becoming a Jehovah's Witness, okay? And they will, by question and answer, go through this paragraph, and they'll say this. We need to examine not only what we personally believe, but also what is taught by any religious organization with which we may be associated. Are its teachings in full harmony with God's Word, or are they based on the traditions of men? If we are lovers of the truth, there is nothing to fear from such an examination. Now, this is the invitation to persons of other faiths to examine their religion.
Right.
But upon threat, actually, of disfellowshipping or excommunication, if a person was to take material that was in opposition to the Watchtower Bible Tract Society and read it and study it and continue to look into it, they would be removed from the congregation.
They do refuse the literature. I have attempted on a number of occasions. In fact, in connection with our program here, we are offering an excellent tract that we could give to a Jehovah's Witness, but they won't accept it, many of them at least. You had to then begin to do some research and some study. You started to doubt the teaching of the Watchtower because 1975, a prophecy was not fulfilled. Now you start to investigate. Investigating the Watchtower was not easy, was it?
No, it's a very frightening experience. You fear for your very standing in the congregation because, especially with my husband being the presiding overseer, for him to question the organization was to question God. That is really what Jehovah's
Witness... In other words, the authority of the Watchtower is
equal
to the authority of God.
Yes. It's when they speak for God. And they have made it very, very clear that we are not to question them. We are to submit to any changes, anything that they teach, whether it's a change from something we previously believed, whatever, we must never question. We must submit quietly and submissively. To question them is to run the risk of being hauled into a secret committee meeting where, in fact, Leonard and I could have been disfellowshipped for apostasy. So, with having read this series of questions, I realized in the over 20 years that I had been a Jehovah's Witness, almost all of those questions I had asked secretly to myself. So I knew that I was on the right track, that there were valid questions and they needed to be answered. With that, Leonard and I attended the summer assembly, the large assembly Jehovah's Witnesses have in the summer, and there were a few persons picketing on the sidewalk. There was a phone number on one of those picket signs. Remember, Leonard is the presiding overseer of this congregation that we are in. We cannot approach these people and speak to them. We've been told not to talk to these picketers. Leonard has me write down the number, and we return home and call that phone number. And that was a outreach ministry in Los Angeles. We listened to the very pleasant and truthful, factual presentation. Leonard rang it up again, and I listened. And they said it at the end that if you wanted further information, you should leave your name. Horrors! The thought of leaving our name with some anonymous phone ministry.
My name is
unknown.
I was getting a couple of calls.
Who would these people be if it ever got out that we were questioning, that we were sending for apostate material or witness material or material critical of the Watchtower organization? Well, you're just so afraid you'll get caught. So we had to send it in under a false name. So we took my middle name and my maiden name, which would be Lenore Lucas, mailed away with a prayer to Jehovah that the mailman would deliver that package.
Mm-hmm.
And we received our very first information.
I think more than the mailman delivered that package.
I agree. Hearing
your story,
I agree.
It gives me chills to hear the grace of God working in your life, because that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you cried out to Jehovah mm-hmm. for the truth, and Jehovah wants to be worshipped in spirit and in truth, and just to hear how he was answering that prayer.
I know it.
There's an interesting side point, which you just reminded me of, as a matter of fact, John, as you said that. After we got those initial package that I mentioned earlier, that started a real series of questions in my mind. I started to question things that I was teaching from the platform and everything. I started to look at it with a different view, you might say, than I had all those many, many years. But I also recognize around that same time there was something going on. I really look back on it now, and I do recognize something very unusual was taking place. We're counseled by the scriptures that there is a wooing of the Holy Spirit. And I think that I can look back now and see and be reminded of how that was taking place. Because as time was going on, we used to have outlines for our public discourses, okay? And in those days, the elders had the authority that we could change them around a little bit, put in our own little anecdotes, do things. Now, today, it's like right off the sheet because they don't want anybody deviating from the Watchtower line, as it were. But I was getting to the point, and I had a number of talks that I would give. I seemed to be in demand for that. But I got to the point, finally, that the only talk that I would permit them to send me out on was the life and death of Jesus Christ. It was the only one I wanted to talk about. It was the one that I had embellished and made my own little changes on and did a few things on. And it was a talk that was well received. Those dear audiences received it very, very well. And I didn't go too far because I still had the misconception that Jesus was Michael the Archangel.
Right.
I didn't totally have it together, okay?
For our listeners, that is the teaching of the Watchtower, that
yes.
Jesus is really Michael the Archangel.
The created super angel Michael, yes,
right.
Exactly. But even a little anecdote, if I can share that anecdote. I remember one night, as an elder, we would get all these various situations come at us. We never knew what they would be at any time of the night or whatever. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was awakened by a family who had had a young woman, a very dear young person, who had been in the Peace Corps and had had some nervous condition as a result of her experiences within that organization overseas. And one of my fellow elders had foolishly told her not to take her medication because this was pharmakia. This was
right.
druggery, which was absolutely very ridiculous for him to have done that. But nevertheless, she had got into a nervous condition this evening over something that went into the morning, and she had the whole family cornered in the kitchen with a butcher knife. And she had agreed that she would talk to me. So I got talking to her, and I think back now and I recall I was talking to her in my own strength. I was cajoling her. I was trying to persuade her. I was doing all of these things. And suddenly, something, as fast as it hit my mind, I said it. I said, "Connie, Jesus loves you." And she came down right off that ceiling and came to a low sobbing.
You must understand, this is a very unusual statement for a Jehovah's Witness to make. I was lying in the bed trying to sleep. This is around 3 in the morning. And my eyes popped right open. And when I heard, "Connie, Jesus loves you," you don't realize, really, Jehovah's Witnesses place very little emphasis on Jesus. And that is very evangelical kind of statement. And I thought, where did that come from? What did Leonard mean by "Jesus loves you"?
Lord was working on you.
And of course, the Lord knew what Connie needed to hear. Leonard was just the instrument to tell Connie what she needed to hear at that moment. Meanwhile, Connie is now out of Jehovah's Witnesses and a member of a Christian church, we're pleased to say.
You know, I keep coming to myself and saying, what were those questions, Leonard? We've heard so much about these questions.
There were hundreds.
Well, it just went on and on. I'm sure there's people sitting here on the edge of their seat saying, "What are those questions?" But what were some of them? We only have about 2 minutes left.
One of the simple ones, not so simple, really quite weighty. For example, it went into the questions concerning the new covenant. Why this would apply only to 144,000 individuals, when in fact the records of history show that more than 144,000 Christians were, in one time, 144,000 or more were put to death by some of the Roman emperors. In fact, millions of Christian era individuals were in the New Covenant. How is it that it was only 144,000 and that Jehovah's Witnesses only had a handle on the few remaining 10,000 or so of them?
I've had
questions
that question.
I
have asked them that kind of question. Other questions? Can you remember a couple of them? I'm sure our listeners will be fascinated to know what it was as a Jehovah's Witness that when you heard this question, you thought, you know, I've asked the same question myself.
Well, very the Alpha and the Omega of Revelation. If one really reads the book of Revelation, Jehovah's Witness divide up the book of Revelation to such a point that they have the Alpha and the Omega as God in some instances, and then it's referring to the first and the last, they see it's Jesus Christ, but meanwhile...
But not God at that point.
At that point, and yet in fact, if you really read all the references together, it really shows it's one and the same,
mm-hmm.
and just, they're just questions saying, why is it that?
Why does it apply here to Jehovah? Why does it change when it's applied to Jesus?
Why did we teach this at a certain time? And in fact, then changed it to this. And then why did we change back to this? It was just getting you to
inconsistencies.
The superior authorities. There's a fine example. Any schoolboy, if you were to read in the book of Romans concerning the superior authorities, you'd know that he's talking about the secular governments.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Christians, as all persons, are to be in relative subjection and submission to, of course. And how that the society had, in the late 20s, early 30s, had said that that's Jesus Christ and God. And persons that didn't agree with that had been disfellowshipped over that. They said, you toe the line or out. And then later on in 1962, the early 60s, they went back to the conventional orthodox position on that. What about those persons who were in this disfellowship state? And according to the Watchtower Society, were in disfavor with God. What had happened to them in their lives and so forth? Questions of that nature. Beth Sarim, it was supposedly a place for Rutherford to rest. No, it was not a place for Rutherford to rest. It was a place for Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and so forth to be resurrected and to begin the ushering in of the new world under the auspices of the Watchtower Society. Horrendous questions. And they went on for 13 pages.
At this point, though, you started to gather a lot of different resources together, didn't you, in order to really investigate the claims of the Watchtower. I understand you have a rather extensive library of materials you've accumulated.
Yes, we do. As a result of our investigation of all this, what happened after we left that, as Marjorie was talking about, when we left that assembly, we came home and I listened to the message first and called again, had her listen to it and send in the name and so on, like we had mentioned, using her maiden name, because we were so concerned about anybody finding out. I mean, you've got this big brother situation hanging over you. And in the pack of material that came, there were a number of books that we could send away for. Now, actually, they were available in our local Christian bookstore, but we wouldn't enter into that bookstore. That's
right.
It would be like entering a church, which is about in the same category. And so we sent away for a few of these books, and I sat, and there are just some excellent ones, Apostles of Denial and so forth. By the time I was finished reading those, and I double-checked them, I thought, now, these people, are they factual? I mean, they're quoting all these old books and all publications of ours and so forth. Are they stretching the truth? Is there any elasticity here? It was flawless. Everything I checked was exactly right out of Watchtower publications. By the time I finished reading those books, and Marjorie was reading them along with me, I remember when I put the last one down, it was July, I believe, tail end of July in 1980, and we had our rotation coming up in September. That's when we did our rotation, mm-hmm. body of elders. And I turned to Marjorie and I said, I'm resigning as an elder in September. That was it. I could no longer stand on the platform and teach these things because I knew that I had been following something that was not of God. And in fact, it was just a man-made foolish organization, some of the things they've said and done.
And Leonard has a list of books that he recommends. We have that at our office, The Art of Family Living. So if someone wants those, the books that you read that helped you to reach this decision, our listeners can write and secure a copy. We'd be glad to send that along. All right, you're at a point now of decision. You're going to break. You're going to say no. You're going to walk away. You've been an elder. You've been a teacher. Your whole life's been involved in the Kingdom Hall. You've been Jehovah's Witnesses most of your adult life. As a married couple, you've gone down this path together. What was it like to then stop and break away? Marjorie?
This is one of the most traumatic times for a person who has been a Jehovah's Witness for as many years as we had. Often you have family members who are Jehovah's Witnesses. You know that if they find out that you have... Well, you just don't know how they're going to receive any comment from you about the Watchtower being untrue. So that was one of our first concerns, to get to an opportunity to speak to my mother and my brother, who were Jehovah's Witnesses in Canada. So we wanted to go slowly. We wanted to be sure what we were doing was right. We wanted to investigate completely all of the documentation we had. So Leonard had to, of course, resign from his eldership. He could not continue, as he said. Yet
We had to do it in such a secret way because we could not let anyone become aware that we were in fact questioning the teachings. Because if it were to be discovered that we had doubts, we would immediately be called into a committee meeting before other elders where we would be questioned extensively on our feelings, what we were reading, and in fact it would have ended up in our being disfellowshipped. So out of knowing what would go into what would happen, we had to be very, very careful in how Leonard went about resigning. And
How did you do it, Leonard?
What I did was, when we had our rotation meeting, I had already actually mentioned it to the other elders that I was going to be doing this for personal reasons, is the way I put it. We felt that I had been very, very busy in that congregation, almost too busy in many respects, and I said that I wanted to just get away from all that responsibility for a while. My daughter had gone through a divorce, as it turned out, and I said that that had been, and it had taken its toll too in its own way. I mean, it had come in on me. So I have to confess, I sort of just glossed over because I didn't have enough information. I was prepared, and I would have been, and to this day, I mean, there's nothing I'd like better than to share the information I have with that same body of elders. I hold no animosity towards them as men, as persons. But I wasn't ready to do that because I didn't have it all really together. But I knew that this thing was wrong, and it was going to take some real careful study and examination to come up with the facts. So nicely, and I was very pleased about this, the problem is if you're an elder in the Jehovah's Witness organization, very, very rarely, unless you have a health condition or, as I had outlined to these gentlemen, what ostensibly was my reason to leave, you don't really step down from that. Or if you're removed, there's always a very negative connotation. Perhaps this man has been taking drugs, or he's been smoking, or he's in some immorality or some such thing. There's a very negative connotation connected with it. But very nicely, and I'm very thankful for that, after the rotation goes on, the new presiding overseer who comes into a position, as it were, always gives a list of the various offices that are going to be held by the various elders and any new ministerial servants and so forth. And during that, he did mention that I had stepped down as an elder, but that the congregation had been well served by me, and that he was sure that they would join him in saying that they look forward to me resuming my duties as an elder in the future. And I was very, very pleased about that, because it didn't leave any negative thing that why did he, you know, what did he do type of thing. So that was a blessing in a way, because I felt very sensitive towards the people in the congregation. I didn't look upon them as people I didn't care about or anything. I cared very much about them.
Later, did you come up front with your doubts and your feelings? How did you do that?
Yeah, that developed, of course. The more we learned, and as we got into this thing, we did develop this extensive library we speak about. And we did speak to one of the elders who was assigned, obviously, to come
very
and call on us
very
carefully. You had to couch your things.
We would have
been
disfellowshipped, and that would have meant that no one would have spoken to us. All of our friends of 22 years would have not spoken to us. So until we came to a point where we were going to send in a letter of disassociation, a resignation letter, we really, really were very, very careful. And that's
and how eventually, though, you did write that letter.
Yeah. We had
and 1982. You were disfellowshipped.
Not actually. They have a provision there, John. If they had disfellowshipped us for apostasy, that would have been it.
Mm-hmm.
But what we did was, rather than do that, we sent in, it's a provision that they allowed, you send in a letter of disassociation or you resign. But the interesting thing is, in effect, it's the same thing. In the September 15th, 1981 Watchtower, they developed a big series of articles to show that disfellowship persons were to be shunned, you're not to have anything to do with them, which was a reversal. That for a little while they had softened up and they went right back to their big old hard position that they'd held for many years. But they included in that article now a new group of people. Because of the hundreds of thousands of people that they're losing, they had now gone into this area of the person who disassociates is to be treated exactly the same way as the disfellowship person or excommunicated
They're
person.
They're to be shunned.
Shunned totally.
What does that mean?
That if you are to meet a witness in a store, they are not to speak to you. Family members are to have no social contact with you at all if they are Jehovah's Witnesses. They will not sit down to a meal with a disassociated Jehovah's Witness. They will not attend your wedding or your funeral. They will handle only family business matters, which are things they cannot escape handling. But they have been told, now, dear family members may have kept up association with a disassociated witness had they been left to their own conscience on the matter. But the Watchtower has told them that they will be disfellowshipped if they keep social company with anyone who has disassociated from the Watchtower Society.
Marjorie, as I look into your eyes, I suspect that's been tough for you. You have some family members who are witnesses.
I do. But I pray for them.
This would be
a mother. My mother and my older brother are still Jehovah's Witnesses. And that makes it difficult, but...
So there's no real chance for communication because you are cut off, or a very limited chance.
Well, it's very strained, and there can be no, I cannot share my joy of Jesus with them. There can be no speaking of scriptural things, only necessary family matters. And even in some instances, we hear of just, because of the ministry that we have now, we get constantly letters and phone calls from persons who have been completely cut off from their families. Mothers and fathers never speaking again to their grown children, never seeing their grandchildren. Grandmothers who have left who are not allowed now to see the grandchildren who are with the Jehovah's Witness children they raised. Complete cutting off. Very, very sad. Very, very sad.
You know, there's an interesting side to this too, John. This is not by accident. This is by design. In actual fact, the Watchtower Bible Tract Society are holding people hostage. I don't think that I would be, it would be untoward for me to say, as far as Jehovah's Witnesses go, the field is white for harvest. The information that is being disseminated through our own little ministry and many, many other fine ministries throughout the country, outreaches to Jehovah's Witnesses, are supplying them with material, and people are coming out left, right, and center. However, there are many persons that are being held hostage because they know if they disassociate themselves or they speak out about the things they're learning, they'll be disfellowshipped, and they'll be in this condition of being cut off from all their friends and relatives. Now, when you think about it, I mentioned at the very beginning a few days ago that we would enter into this organization and have to cut off all of your old friends and so on because they're worldly associations. Even cutting off your relatives, your fleshly relatives, that really don't subscribe to your new persuasion. Now, that's bad enough that would happen to a person, but think about individuals then that are in an organization that the only friends they have, the only associations they have are Jehovah's Witnesses.
Right.
Now, if you are disfellowshipped and or if you disassociate, like I mentioned, what happens to you? You have nobody. You have nobody. Except that you have Jesus Christ, and there are many, many other persons that will come that he will provide, because as he said, I will not leave you as orphans. I will come to you.
I think that it was brought home to me so clearly in just the few months after we disassociated ourselves, I had to fill out an application form, which required that I put down three references of persons who had known me for a period of time, and I could fill no names in.
Mm.
And here I was, a woman in my late 40s, and could not come, I didn't know how I was going to explain it.
Your whole life
to these people I had to fill the form out for. How could I explain that I had no one in, after all this time of my life, that I could put down?
Now, the search really begins in many ways. You found out that you had some things that just weren't true. How did you come to the truth?
Well, that took considerable study because, as we mentioned before, you look upon the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society, or the society, as we would call it, as God's organization. And whatever was published in the various journals and so forth is what you accepted as truth. And, you see, you have to realize that everything had to be very, very rational with the Watchtower. Everything had to be in a box. They had to put God in a box, and they had to put Jesus Christ in another box, that he was Michael the Archangel, and so forth. And you accepted these things on face value. And as we got into our study and began to realize that if they were wrong in all these other areas, the false prophecies and many, many other things that we didn't really touch on, but so many things, they have to be wrong in their theology as well, because it's the grassroots basic crux of the whole matter. And yes, we did have to, we began to realize, and we saw it very, very clearly, that salvation was not in an organization, because they teach that salvation is through that organization, vicariously, as it were, through them and through the remnant of the 144,000. But actually, our salvation is in the person of Jesus Christ. And we recognize now that the truth shall make you free, because we are free. We are free in Christ. We no longer have the bondage of watchtower servitude. We delight in serving the Lord. And when they used to like to say in John 17:3, this means everlasting life, they're taking in knowledge of you. They stress and use and exegete that in such a way that you're continuing ongoing knowledge that you will gather. Your meeting attendance and this taking in of knowledge is what's going to give you salvation. They don't teach and understand that it's the knowing, it's the understanding, it's the personal relationship that you have with Jesus Christ. That's what's being taught in John 17:3, a knowing, an intimate knowing, not general knowledge. And when you come to understand these things and you see these things in their true light, then you have a heavy, heavy burden lifted from your shoulders. And you say to yourself, may it be that the Lord can use me now, that He will treat me in an intimate way as I would desire to be treated, and permit me to speak about Him and His works here on the planet. And it's a very, very, very simple message, really.
And Leonard, in your case, you had a lot of, let's call it theological baggage that you had unload. I mean, you were told that Jesus was the first created being, was really Michael the Archangel, and was not, of course, God Himself. You had to come to the realization that Jesus Christ was the second person of the Trinity, is Himself God. And, of course, that had to take some time. None of us can really understand it. The Bible really does teach it clearly.
It takes a long time. And the fact of the matter is, there are things that are referred to as antinomies. These are things that are beyond the scope of human reason. There's a chasm, obviously, of reason that we can't just breach.
Right.
Not in this life. Obviously, in the next, we will understand.
Right, and antinomy would be an apparent paradox. We can't understand
paradox,
how God
exactly.
can be sovereign, yet we're responsible and have a will that dictates our eternal destiny. And we can't understand the Trinity. You know, there's an apparent paradox that there could be three persons, one God, each of the persons being completely God. Yeah, we're not going to be able to comprehend it. You know, as it's been said of the Trinity, you know, to try to understand it, you'll lose your mind. If you fail to accept it, you'll lose your soul.
Yes.
And but Marjorie, for you, I think you came to a point where it was time to say, "Hey, Lord, yes." Tell
yes.
us about it.
Well, the saddest thing can be when persons leave the watchtower because they have been so poisoned against the Christian teachings that they sit out there in kind of a spiritual limbo. But thanks be to God, I've looked at it that God hadn't moved. It was me. I was the one who had gotten sidetracked. So with Bible reading, I came to realize that really Jesus was the way, the truth, and the life, not an organization. So with that, I just gave my life to Christ, and I knew really for the first time the joy that the Scriptures speak about. As a Jehovah's Witness, you're told that you're to have joy in the work that you do. And I didn't have that joy, and I always felt, well, what's wrong with me? You know, what am I not doing right? I certainly try hard enough. I certainly pray enough. I certainly go door to door enough, but I didn't have this joy. Well, I tell you, when I accepted the Lord, I had joy.
You still
joy, have. Joy. And it was just, it was there, and I knew for the first time that joy of the Bible.
Again,
beautiful.
I feel the limitations of radio. I wish everyone could see your face as you say that, because you do radiate that joy. And in our time together, I've appreciated the way that I've seen your eyes fill up with tears, remembering how good God has been. And He has been good. He's brought you out of that to Himself and to a personal relationship. He's also using you in some unique ways. But first, let me ask you, have you had witnesses that you've known in the past? Have they come to you since you have come to Christ? Have you had some opportunities?
Yes, we have many opportunities. We've had a number of witnesses that, as a matter of fact, are still witnesses in good standing, and that they have not been disfellowshipped or didn't disassociate themselves like Marjorie and I did. We resigned, as I mentioned before. Recently, we had a dear young lady. We can't mention her name, of course, because her parents would be very upset, and we're not trying to do that to her. Come and visit us from far away and spend time with us, and it was just a beautiful joy. And she, in fact, as a witness in good standing, commended us for what we're doing and just thanked us from the bottom of her heart for the time that we spent with her and so forth. And this is happening on a daily basis. We have phone calls. We have people. We're just helping a couple now that were in the witnesses who they're ready to put in their letter of resignation and so on. And this is going on basically weekly with us.
Yes, you must realize that within the past 10 years, 1 million people have left Jehovah's Witnesses.
Now, you know that? The last 10 years,
yes.
1 million people mm-hmm. have left.
Now, that is the effect of the 1975 sales date, you see. Using their own yearbooks, their own statistics, one can just add it all up and you come up with 1 million people that have left. As we said earlier, a lot of them go off into kind of a spiritual limbo. They don't know what to do. But then a lot of them, too, do connect with those of us who have left. There's a wonderful, loosely knit network of former Jehovah's Witnesses around the world right now. Everyone connects and sees that these persons who do surface and do want to know more, we connect each other in wherever we are to that person so that they might, in fact, hear the true gospel and get on a spiritual road again. And that's really something that Leonard and I are doing right now. Working with people to help.
What
them.
Is the name of your organization again?
We call it Good News Defenders.
Good News
Defense
Defenders.
Is good news, as it were, and we feel that it serves the body of Christ, certainly the best of our ability in our area, and actually we're even sending our material, frankly, all over the place, all over the world.
What I'm excited about is very soon you're going to have a film come out. You don't even have the title of the film yet, I guess, do you?
Yes, we
do.
You
have a title.
Very simply, we decided we didn't want it to sound polemic. There's two purposes to the film. That's to immunize the body of Christ against this threat so that they themselves will not fall victim to it, and to reach those dear lost souls in the Watchtower. And we had come up with all kinds of fancy titles, and we realized that some of them were too polemic. They were just too attack-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
It's simply going to be called Witnesses of Jehovah. And we are co-producing that with a film company that produced one on Mormons, actually.
The Godmakers?
The Godmakers,
right.
Yes. And that was a 56-minute documentary, and this one will be, too. And we're hoping to have it released by late this summer.
But I know there's some people right now listening to the program. They look down the street, and they see two people coming, and they're from the Kingdom Hall. What would you recommend they do?
Well, if a person is qualified with the Scriptures, and they would like to discuss some of these scriptural doctrines with Jehovah's Witnesses, that's a fine thing. Very, very fine. If they don't feel that they're qualified for that, or they just don't choose to do that, a fine testimony of their own salvation can be shared with these witnesses. Because when I went door to door, there were a number of times, and I can remember leaving that door knowing that the victory was in the hands of the householder, because I knew how I felt when I left that door, because I received some of those testimonies from fine evangelical Christian persons, and they made a mark on me. They made me think. And at the same time, what we're hoping to do is reach these people. And one of the fastest ways for them to divest themselves of this Watchtower error is to have a credibility gap between them and the organization. And a very, very succinct and easy question to ask them is, have you ever predicted things in the past that didn't come about? And they'll likely say, if they're honest persons, well, yes, we have. And you could certainly mention some of the things that we've talked about earlier in the show. And we could say, then how can I be sure that what you are telling me now will really happen? Let them...
It's a very general question, a very loving way to kind of interact with them and hopefully open them up to question the Watchtower's teaching.
Yes.
What I'd like to do is consider that person coming to the door, the Jehovah's Witness, and they come in twos. And, of course, for many years you were in the Jehovah's Witness faith. You understood the teaching of the Watchtower. Leonard was an elder and a teacher. They are well-schooled, as I understand it, in preparing to come to that door and knock on that door to proselytize, to win converts. What is the training like?
Well, it's a very highly organized training, in that there are scheduled meetings. Now, some of the meetings are, of course, strictly indoctrination meetings. For example, the Tuesday night book study, 1 hour a week, where the witnesses will take one of the latest books of the Watchtower, a study book, and whatever it happens to be, if they're teaching on the kingdom or whatever it may be, they will, as a group, study by question and answer, paragraph with questions on the paragraph, mm-hmm. so that the actual doctrines of the Watchtower Bible Tract Society are sounded deeply into the individuals on that personal book study level. And that's done in individual homes throughout the area. A congregation of 150 persons could have, possibly 10 book study groups in that given area.
Are these pretty much required? I mean, if you're not there, they're going to say, where are you?
Yeah, actually, if you don't attend meetings, really the elders will take notice of this, of course, and even give you some counsel. But then there's this little built-in thing that if somebody in your group isn't there, the next time you see them, you almost make a little inquiry as to, oh, I didn't see you. Were you ill? And there was the connotation being that had to be a very good reason for you not to be there at that...
heavy peer pressure.
Peer pressure.
And an accountability, which is missing in Christian churches, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, then even heavier, the Thursday night theocratic ministry school and service meeting would be even more of a teaching area for the witnesses to go out and do their door-to-door ministry or activity, service, as they would like to call it. The theocratic school is a training for the brothers and the sisters, for the men and the women, how to give presentations at the door. There's an instruction talk, of course, which is given by an individual male. And then there are these various other parts where a person would be... setting a scene of one lady talking to another lady in an actual Bible study setting, and she's taking a certain section that's been assigned. It's done in a very mm-hmm. organized way, so it's done in all the congregations throughout the land at the same time, and she would give her slant as to how she would be persuading, as it were, this individual on some certain doctrinal point or whatever. So everybody in the audience is listening to this, obviously. She's going to be counseled on the manner in which she did this, and so forth. The service meeting... at the risk of sounding facetious or something, it's almost akin to a sales meeting. What it is basically a way of putting out the literature, the most effective manner of putting out the literature in a door-to-door work. It can have to do with a particular bound book or a Bible that they're offering, or the magazines, the Watchtower and the Awake, whatever. But also very, very highly organized in the area of overcoming objections, a standard objection that a person might bring up, how you would get around that, how you'd either slip around it or face on, as it were, and handle it.
Leonard, it's blowing me away as I think through the fact that for 15 years you were devout Jehovah's Witnesses. If you were to put in your 2 hours a week in preparation...
It's actually 22 years, John.
22 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you multiply that times the number of weeks, times the number of hours, it is staggering the preparation you had to go to someone's door to lead them into Watchtower teaching. And I hate to admit it, but the fact of the matter is we in our churches aren't doing one half the job that the witnesses are doing in training people in the truth. And it disturbs me greatly because I know we have so many people listening right now that a sharp Jehovah's Witness could come to the door and literally blow their theological doors off and blow them away.
Quite possible.
And that's why we're having the program. That's why we appreciate your ministry. And that's why we're a family ministry, but we're concerned about protecting our young people and our families from false teaching, especially when we have people who are trained in attacking Christian doctrines, as you were so well trained. Marjorie, you probably think back to some of those meetings. You attended those together, is that what it would be?
Oh, yes. Really, there are 5 meetings a week, 5 hours of instruction a week that a witness is expected to attend. And that goes on month in and month out and year out. It's one of the expectations. If you are to be counted as a mature Jehovah's Witness, you are to attend those meetings. You're expected to put 10 hours minimum door-to-door ministry in as well, conducting Bible studies mm-hmm. and calling on people at their
home. That's
homes.
A month, 10 hours
that's
a month?
That's in a month.
So that's why we see them at my
exactly.
door. They've been to my house several times the last couple months.
Jehovah's Witnesses last year alone put in 600 million hours going door-to-door around the world. So when you realize this means that a Jehovah's Witness is going to call on your door a couple of times each year, and if you are not firmly grounded in your faith, you certainly are going to be faced with someone who has been trained to take apart your belief system. So we really, really encouraged Christians to get the basics of their faith well grounded into their heart so that they're not going to fall victim to the very, very well-schooled training that the Jehovah's Witness gets.
All right, let's turn back the hands of time about 12 years. I see this very attractive couple walking down the street toward my house. My word, it's Leonard and Marjorie Crittenden. They're coming. Here they are. They knock on my door. I open it up, and you introduce yourselves, and we get talking a little bit. And I say to you, well, you know, I've seen your Kingdom Hall down the street there. Are you saved? What do they teach you to say? Do they instruct you?
Yes, they do.
Very interestingly, just in this past year or so, the Watchtower has supplied their followers with a book called Reasoning from the Scriptures. And this book is provided to answer the questions or objections that persons might give to them at the door. And it starts out with saying, if someone should say or ask you at the door, are you saved? Then it goes on to give an answer. Here's the answer the Jehovah's Witness is supposed to give. I could answer that simply by saying yes. But did you know that the Bible speaks of more than one salvation? And then you're to go on to talk about the plan of salvation. Meanwhile, the witnesses here said, yes, to your question, are you saved? This is just not true. Jehovah's Witnesses do not believe that they are saved. So it is a form of deception to get past a common objection.
It's really a sales technique. Yes. It's very common to kind of assume consent or just allow the person to say whatever they want, but you go on to your point regardless.
You get over the hurdle.
Yeah, what's interesting, of course, in some ways with evangelism, we do some of the same things, but of course our motivation is to challenge someone to come to Christ, and it's done rather frontally, I think, with the techniques that, of course, I'm familiar with. How about another question? Another question that I would maybe ask would be, well, are you born again? Of course, that's a phrase that's been thrown around for a number of years now. I mean, so they're schooled in responding even to something like that.
Well, the reasoning from the Scriptures again says that if you have been asked, have you been born again, you're to answer, may I assure you that the answer is yes. Otherwise, I would not be talking to you about Jesus. Again, this is totally untrue. Jehovah's Witnesses, the large majority of them, do not consider themselves to be born again. There are only a very small, over 9,000, elite group of Jehovah's Witnesses who consider themselves to be born again.
Is that part of their teaching?
Yes.
Is that what that is?
The majority of Jehovah's Witnesses do not have Jesus Christ as their mediator. They are not in the new covenant, and they are not born again.
So in other words, they do believe that some, an elite group, are born again, but the vast majority are not.
Yes. Yeah. But it is another deceptive statement to get over the hurdle, get past that with the householder, and get on to what they want to say. But it's a fine form of lying, really.
What we have to remember is when you're dealing in that very, very area there, for example, which is kind of an interesting one when you think about it, to ask a question like that, it would be a very natural question for a Christian to ask a person who's come to their door. You've got to remember that Jehovah's Witnesses is actually a two-class religion. That is, the 144,000 spoken of in Revelation 7 and Revelation 14 are the only ones that are in the new covenant, according to them. And, of course, they teach that this 144,000 are the only ones that have ever and will ever gone to heaven. And that is right now from the day of Pentecost right to the present time, of which there's only a handful of them left.
Okay, Leonard, we have a couple minutes left, really only a minute and a half. If you wanted to try to reach me, and I'm a nominal Christian, I don't really know my Bible, where would you begin? What would they go after with me?
Well, probably the first thing they'd ask you about is what you felt about world conditions. They really like this one. They like to play up the fact that everything that's going on the planet right now are signs of the imminent destruction of the earth, that the world is coming to an end, that this is the last days and so forth. But that the interesting thing is they will turn it around, that they do have a solution to all of this, and they'd like to spend some time breaking this down for you, showing you there is a way.
So they would say to me, well, are you concerned about some of the things you see happening?
It's a very typical question.
Okay. And then,
very typical.
So essentially what they are doing is they are taking their understanding of prophecy, which we do not agree with, but their understanding of prophecy, they're using current events to create the interest. And then they open up a relationship by utilizing this kind of relationship. They're trying to get you to respond to current events, some of the things you're feeling, and then they bridge the relationship. Is that it?
Yeah, and then they contrast it with the marvelous new world right around the corner. In other words, you are alive today, and you have the opportunity of entering into this new world. It's that close.
I'm just wondering. Go ahead.
Okay, they pick up on your concern for the things that are happening in the world today and the desire that all mankind has for peace, for peaceful conditions between all the races and so forth. And then they use their scriptures to show that this is going to happen very, very soon, that soon all of this is going to be wiped away, and that a paradise earth is going to be restored just as it was in the time of Adam and Eve, and that in fact you, the individual, if you come into line with what they are teaching, stand to live forever in perfect health and never grow old and die. And when one thinks of it, I think one could sell eternal life in a paradise earth all day long. It's a beautiful package, and a lot of people are attracted to it.
You can't beat that deal. I'm just wondering, how many doors do you think you knocked on?
Oh, thousands.
Hundreds of thousands. If I was to figure going out 10 hours minimum per month and being able to say in that time period, 300-400 houses, whatever. Multiply that times 52 weeks, multiply that by 22 years. It's a number of doors,
And somebody else knocked on your door, and that's the Lord Jesus Christ.
Right.
I'm glad
that's
you
right.
both answered. Again, our guests, Leonard and Marjorie Chretien, and we appreciate so much their testimony of being saved out of the Watchtower Society.